Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus,
Makalua,
the Man Team,
Mega Bears Fan.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to 363. Is that the correct number?
Yes.
I believe it is, yes. Welcome to Polycast episode 363. I am finally back, Canis Albinus, and we're joined with our regular group of Makalua.
Still not enough caffeine at this point in the day.
Mega Bears Fan. Oops, got that backwards.
Yes, indeed. Mornings are quite difficult.
And the Mian Team, okay, that's the right one.
Always flanking from all sides. Always.
See, if you're on your team, you have a flanking bonus.
Show you a flanking bonus.
All right,
is it a flanking bonus that's capped at 3?
No, there's no cap. After all, the best strategy is surround and pound. Speaking of surround and pound, question mark? Yeah, that's a great way to lead into an article
you
about
the audio.
Oh, no!
You did it again!
I fell!
Yeah.
Mistakes were made. So, as I was saying before, I was so...
You still skipped it!
No!
There's two!
You're right. It says it right there. Now I should just be quiet.
Now I'm talk about it.
Now I should just be quiet. Okay, so now that I've been interrupted twice by the show running properly, let's just talk about Gandhi again. So there's a rock, paper, shotgun article here about how Gandhi is failed by video games or whatever, and this is also now a closed thread on Civ Fanatics. It was not closed, I don't think, as of the time originally looked at this as a topic.
Yeah, we've been sitting on this one for quite a few weeks now.
Yeah. So the gist of it is that him being a leader in the game can't do him justice because of the type of figure he was in history, which I feel is not really fair. Like, many of the leaders in the game aren't really consistent with how they were in history. Like, you have to take some license to that. That being said, despite all the flaws in the arguments throughout the article, I do broadly agree that Gandhi should not be a leader of India compared to other options that would be perfectly viable for India in the game that were actually leaders of India in different times in history. And he is one of the more overdone leaders as well when it comes to the Civ franchise. So, in that way, I agree.
One could argue.
You guys have any thoughts on this?
One could argue that India shouldn't be a Civ in and of itself because it's actually like 500 Civs all put together in a weird mash. I mean, we could have a Mughals, and we could have a Marathi, and we could have some other stuff like that. But
Mughals should be their own Civ, and
yeah.
I've been on record saying that plenty of times. And yeah, they would not be appropriate as an India replacement or something, because they were a nation that conquered India and ruled it for a time. That being said, even if we have Mughals, we've had something close to a unified India a few times in history. So I don't know that, like, you can't compare modern India to, like, the times of Ashoka or something. They're definitely different, like, they have different backstories and everything. Everything that led to their formation as a nation, it's the same territory, but calling Ashoka's India, like the same as modern India, is kind of like calling Ottomans and Byzantium or Eastern Rome or whatever the same thing. Like, it's kind of silly. So, yeah, you're right. There should be multiple Indias, but I would kind of hate to see, like, things like the Mysore Empire not represented in using the unified Indias only.
Maybe why they went this route, because when you have so many diverse variations of culture, if you pick one, it you're not snubbing the others, but somebody will go on the forums and, hey, what about my people or my part of India or something like that?
Well, I think that's fair, right? The Indian subcontinent is freaking huge and has a storied history, and we've had one Civ representing Civ representing that region for how long now? Like
25 years.
Yeah, and I would love to see, actually, I mean, as I don't know as much about Indian history, I would like to see some of those more individual states who had big impacts on the longer-term Indian history, air quote, I mean, you know, of the subcontinent.
And to Civ's credit, I would like to point out that, you know, Civ 6 and I think also Civ 4 had multiple leaders for India that did represent some of those different periods and different cultural groups. So it's not the case that it has always been Gandhi and only Gandhi and nothing but Gandhi and screw you if you ask for someone other than Gandhi. that is certainly not the case.
Well, Civ 5 did that, but other than that.
Well, Civ 5 had a single leader for, you know, every Civ, so... you know, India wasn't the only Civ in Civ 5 that had that problem.
That's true.
And one of the more interesting points that I think this article makes is the idea that, like, the actual historic figure of Gandhi not only was never a leader in any, you know, political sense, but his entire life was, like, defined by his dissent against, you know, the established authority. So, like,
that's a fair point too.
He's like the exact opposite of how he is portrayed in the Civilization games. Like, the article argues that it would make more sense for him to be like a group of like rebels or, you know, something like that, that, you know, spawn and then I guess sit on your resources and do hunger protests until you change your policies.
That'd be a bit of a PR nightmare.
Right, yeah. Like, he never had any political, he was never, as far as I know, never in any elected or, you know, unelected, like, political leadership position. You know, it was always, you know, doing things like leading protest movements. It would be analogous to having, like, Martin Luther King Jr., you know, being, like, the leader of the United States of America in a game. Like, kind of missing the point here, buddy.
He just screams great person to me, personally. Like, if Joe and I were to include him in a Civ game, that's what he would be.
Yeah, I've actually thought in the past about the ideas of maybe having, like, a great humanitarian, great person, and...
Yeah, well, you need something so along the humanitarian or philosopher line to represent some of the people, because the fluff we do have doesn't quite fit some of the more interesting historic figures that all these different civs could have.
Yeah, and someone like Gandhi or MLK would be, like, you know, perfect fit for something like that.
Well, true. Like, you could have him be a great person that gives culture. Like, that's not unreasonable at all, considering how people remember him.
So what can these great philosophers be, like, a culture bomb of a sort that... Maybe you have a city, that particular city now becomes famous and cultural because that person came from there, you know.
Yeah. Or, you know, a great person that does something like provides extra amenity or, you know, something like that as well would be, you know, different ways of implementing something like that. Or, of course, you know, if the game actually, like, implemented, you know, more demographic things where you actually had things like, you know, hunger and starvation and illiteracy and poverty in your cities, and the game actually modeled those things, then, you know, you might have a great humanitarian unit that would maybe, you know, offset some of those things by providing extra housing and food and amenity and, you know, literacy.
Housing.
He does model those things. It just doesn't do it, like, at the discrete level. And that's an area where the article says straight up not accurate.
Like, yeah, it doesn't seem to the point
where
you're
significant constraint. And it has been even before Civ 4, but it was really crippling in Civ 4, but it's still bad now if you're way under on it.
Yeah, housing is a bad example. That just kind of, like, you know, came out as a train of thought thing. But, like, the other things, like, again, you don't, like, yes, you do need to feed your population. You do, in Civ 6, need to have housing for your cities to grow. But your citizens aren't going to, like, outright revolt against your rule, you know, because they don't have enough food or they don't have enough housing. It's just a limiter on growth. It's kind of
in Civ 3.
Yeah, you can go back to previous installments in the Civ series, and that would be different. You know, that would actually be something that might cause revolt and stuff like that. But I started the series on Civ 3 and only played it a little bit before moving on to Civ 4, so I don't remember a lot of the details of those mechanics.
I did as well. I never managed to win a game.
Civ 4 had revolts, too. They didn't, like, change ownership of the city, but you could... Well, actually, you could if you got culture flipped. But even if you didn't get culture flipped, a city revolting would be... It would lose you turns from that city. Like, that city would do nothing while it was in anarchy.
Make Gandhi the biggest screw-you unit in the game, a great person that just goes and auto-culture flips your city.
There you go.
Yeah, we will make him a unique rock band, lol.
He just uses a charge and he just grants independence to every city that's ever been conquered throughout the entire game.
Oh
my gosh.
God, take that.
He's the city-state.
Oh my god, that would be so awful.
Maybe make it work so that it only works on captured capitals.
Oh, that was a total like joke troll thing. That was not at all serious.
No, I mean the single city release.
But I do.
I don't think that would be a really helpful effect. You know, sometimes it could be, but in most cases, like if you just flip one city into independence like that, it's just going to get reconquered or even flipped right back.
Yeah, that's all.
Well, that would make it balanced.
But I also remember, like, this is kind of a similar, you know, analogous example, but if I remember correctly, I think it was the Cree Nation, like, actually, like, had some kind of, like, legal issue with Civ 6 after Poundmaker was introduced into the game. So I guess even though they, like, approved it, like, they gave Fraxis permission to use the leader, like, I guess no one on the council or whatever had ever actually, like, played Civilization, and when they actually saw the game that he was in, like, I guess they got upset that, like, he was still able to do things like declare wars and backstab other players and stuff like that, just like every other leader in the game is allowed to do. So it's kind of like a similar situation where they felt like that, you know, particular historic figure was not being properly represented, as, you know, just fitting into the mechanics that are, you know, the way that Civ leaders have always worked.
As I remember it, that controversy was less about what Civ was and more about some random chief of the Cree came out and said, blah, blah, I'm upset that you're using my historical leader in your game. And there was no real, like, it was like a puff piece or something.
Yeah,
but I could be wrong.
It was not.
I don't remember it being a controversy. I remember it being an article, a single periodic, once.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's probably a more accurate way of saying it. But if I remember, I did read the article, and if I remember correctly, that, you know, particular individual or small group of individuals was upset with the fact that, you know, you basically could play the Cree and Poundmaker as a militaristic, you know, conquering Civ. And they just felt like that was completely, like, antithetical to who that person was historically. Which, you know, is, like, the same kind of idea that's going on here with Gandhi, is the fact that you can play Gandhi the same way that you can play, the same way that you can play Genghis Khan, you know, in Civilization is completely, you know, antithetical to who he was as a, you know, person and historical figure.
Well, if we want to go full historical revisionist, we could argue that anybody in any given position could equally become anybody else, but that's one of those things that actually turns the argument into a pain in the butt and not worth listening to, so.
Yeah, that's way outside of the scope of what we're trying to talk about here.
But that's true, like, if you fit anybody into a game model, their behavior has to at least somewhat reflect the circumstances of the game model, as opposed to their circumstances in history, which are necessarily different. So we should expect at least some different behavior no matter what, and how different depends on how different the game is from history.
Yeah, especially in a game that is as broad in scale and scope as, you know, Civilization. Like, this article from Rock, Paper, Shotgun also has an example of Gandhi in... the 1980s game Nuclear War, right, where he is, like, the fourth player with Richard Nixon, Gorbachev, and Colonel Gaddafi in a game that's, like, all about just, I guess, building nukes and missiles and airplanes and stuff like that. So, like, that's
quite a... It's quite
probably
a
an even worse question example.
People, huh?
I like how Gorbachev is spelled with an F.
Yeah. Gorbachev.
Gorbachev.
He's cooking you?
Yeah.
That's literally.
So his depiction in Civilization is probably also not the worst video game depiction of Gandhi that's ever been released either. So.
But does this mean that Nuclear Gandhi actually existed before the Civ 1 bug?
Possibly. I never played Nuclear War, so I have no idea how Gandhi... I mean, maybe, like, since they only had four leaders in that game, maybe Gandhi did play completely differently than the others and, you know, was peaceful and couldn't build nukes and stuff like that. I have no idea.
It looks like they're using it as a foil for the others who are not pacifists.
Right.
Because it seems really weird that you'd have Gandhi opposed to these three dudes.
One of these things is not like the others.
I mean, if they took out Gaddafi and put in somebody like, you know, who's another country that has no interest in blowing up? Japan or
Sweden.
Or well, Sweden.
Japan's not
Switzerland, yeah. But if it was anybody else who was less active warlord, it would be a little bit more...
Well, the second paragraph of this article from Rock, Paper, Shotgun suggests that in that game, Nuclear War, like, Gandhi had a pacifism trait, and it was treated like a handicap. So I'm assuming that other than that, like, he played mechanically similarly to the other, you know, three or however the heck any more leaders there were in the game. So I'm imagining something similar to Civilization, just where, like, yeah, as part of his, you know, leader ability or whatever, he's not allowed to declare war or something like that.
I'm just looking at this screenshot, and it's terrifying, because it has a 100 meg button, and that would...
That's two of them.
Yeah, that is
not enough.
Either warhead or missile. Like, that is a terrifying prospect. I think we can end on that.
Pressure in real life.
That would be, yeah. The biggest bomb they ever set off was a 50 megaton bomb. You could, like, feel it, like 400 miles away. Is that powerful?
North Honda?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Maybe you can prevent that with alliances?
I'm really glad that brinksmanship is not a thing.
Yes. Who's got the biggest nuclear, you know what? Yeah. Anyway, alliances. Over on Symphonetics, the clue with that had started to ask how people feel about ones. If you like them, you hate them, you're slightly nervous. Had some random thoughts and they were, alliance? I mean, okay. Before I start into that, I know that in multiplayer, the alliances work great because you can do that with somebody. You could be opposite ends of the continent, you've got a mutual enemy in the middle, and you two can have a military, so if one of you gets declared on, you can jump right in. Or if you're over in a corner and your economy, you know, you can either bolster your economic side or your science side, because some of the Ford AI does run away. Because all it takes is that you ignore one AI in a corner, and the next thing you know, oh dear. What was it the other day? How much did Philip have? 2,000 military strength?
Yeah, something like that.
Just like, what? But he did, okay, in the random thoughts. Alliances weirdly don't seem to have much to do with actual diplomacy. You know, they try to get, they send in a few gifts, as trade deals, an open border, you know, try not to settle close to them, maybe get into a joint war, but sometimes they'll go for it and sometimes they won't. And it just seems like it's in, almost like it's, I guess you say it's almost like it's independent of whether you... It's like there's a threshold of relationship you have to even propose it. But it just is like whether the AI feels like it or not, I don't know how to, you know.
I do want to point out that I think A Clue Without neglects to mention that alliances are one of the principal sources of diplomatic favor in Civ 6 Gathering Storm. And that is their probably biggest tie-in to diplomacy, because that's the currency that you use to do things in the World Congress.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and if you're trying to go for a diplomatic victory as well, that would help.
Yeah, so city-state suzerains and alliances are, like, the best ways to get diplomatic favor points in the game, which is, you know, a direct path to the, quote, diplomatic victory. So even though the alliance, like, might not directly you know, have much impact diplomatically other than, you know, basically giving you better trade deals, it is, you know, closely tied into the diplomatic victory and world progress.
I do like that there's tangible reasons to run alliances, both if you're going for a victory or a diplomatic victory, and if you're not, you still get yields that otherwise you would not get by making alliances.
Yeah, the whistle bank.
And so does the person you're allying. So there's actual tangible in-game incentive to work with each other.
Yeah, although one thing that does annoy me in Civ 6 in particular is, like, you have to have, you have to be pretty far into the game and have certain policies before there's reciprocal benefits to trade routes, because at the start of the game, it only provides bonuses to the player who's sending them, which means there's, like, absolutely no, you know, reason to not send a trade route to a player who might potentially turn into an enemy, because you're not giving them anything other than, you know, maybe a road.
Well, yeah, they can plunder your trade route, though.
Yeah, that's true, but I think if a war is declared, the trade route is canceled, and your trader unit automatically goes back to, like, the city that it came from. Like, I don't even think it's automatically destroyed. I think that was the case in Civ 5, but I think in Civ 6, it just ends the route, and your trade unit goes back to the city.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
So even a surprise war, like, isn't a deterrent to sending a trade route to a potential enemy. And, again, I've noticed, you know, the AI does it all the time, where they send a trade route to you just to build a road, right? And you see the trader coming, and then there's a carpet of units that follows it. And it's like, whoa, 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 what's going on here?
Well, I mean, you've got to build roads to your future cities, after all.
Yeah.
And it's like the only way to build roads in the game, which is kind of silly. But with that being the case... Yeah, you probably should send the traders for that then. But
right,
for the most part, extended trade deals with somebody you're working with long-term makes sense.
Yeah, I would definitely like to see those reciprocal trade benefits be in play, like, earlier in the game, if not at the very start, because I think that was a really interesting, you know, strategic element of Civ 5, was deciding whether or not it benefited you, but is it worth giving the other player, you know, like, free gold and other yields as well.
Yeah, because you find that early on can make the difference between them staying at an even level or becoming that monster you're going to have to go kill later.
Yeah, and that's just not a factor in Civ 6 at all until you're, like, more than halfway through the game. And like I said, you've got, like, all kinds of policies and stuff like that that start granting those reciprocal benefits.
Yeah,
and most of the reciprocal benefits come from the alliance, which means you're already on good terms with that other Civ, and you don't have to worry so much about them suddenly backstabbing and betraying you. Not that that doesn't happen, but it's less of a worry than you just sending it to your immediate neighbor at, like, turn 20 of the game, even if that neighbor happens to be, like, Alexander or Montezuma or someone like that, and, you know, eventually they're coming for you.
Betrayal, let's see.
I'll say what else did. Like, they like that it's conceptually about how they're about defending against certain victory types. Like, you don't do an elite, you don't take a research alliance to win a space race, and you take it because another player you aren't focusing on, you know, it's supplementing something.
Really true. Like, first of all, as Mayor Bearson mentioned, you would be making alliances to pursue a diplomatic victory condition. So, you're not just defending against victory conditions, but making alliances. But even so, like, as long as you're getting some benefit, even as a front runner, to win more quickly, it can make sense to use alliances to work towards your victory condition specifically, in addition to defending against them. Like, I don't see the distinction here.
Yeah, there's no reason at all to not just make a research alliance with the most illiterate Civ in the game, because the yields are, like, static. Like, the yields don't scale, like, based on how much research the other Civ is or is not generated. Like, if it were the case where, you know, the fact that I'm in the lead on science means that the Civ that I give my research alliance to is going to get even more science than I'm going to get from them. Like, if that were the case, then maybe, yes, this would be true. But as far as I know, that's not the case. You just get, like, what is it, like, +2 science beakers or whatever per turn for, you know, either side of the alliance, and then as the alliance levels up, it's, like, one more for each level or something like that.
Even if it were static, even if it's scaled, it would often still make sense, because you're benefiting yourself and somebody else, and that's relative to everybody else on the board. And so typically you want to make as many deals like that as you can.
Yeah, and if you're so far ahead, like if you're in the atomic era and you're sending, Research Alliance to someone who still, is working on Renaissance tech, I mean, who cares if they're going to get into the industrial era a few turns sooner? Like, they're still not going to compete with you for the space race.
Yeah, although they shouldn't be making that alliance with you then, probably because it's growing. But from your perspective, it makes sense.
Yeah, well, I don't think the AI really cares all that much which alliance you offer them. I think if they like you, they'll take pretty much any alliance you
have. I know it doesn't, but it probably should, so long as victory conditions are a thing.
Right, yeah, no, I agree.
Too nuanced for it, perhaps.
So there's a second point from A Clue Without that we disagree somewhat with.
Let's see. And also the downside to life, you can't murder your friend directly, or if you do, you can incur an emergency, but that's diplomacy in the whole game, though.
I don't like that your ally can act against you by doing things like conquering your city states, and you have no recourse other than to trigger an emergency in response to effectively them betraying you in that context. That is still annoying.
Well, and one of the other nuances of this mechanic is I think you still, that other player, I think, is the only player that can propose the backstab emergency. Can any player propose that, or is it only the player who was backstabbed? I don't see it happen often enough, so I'm not sure. But in any case, whoever proposes it needs the diplomatic favor to be able to propose it to begin with, and then also needs enough support from the other kids in the game for them to actually vote to approve it. So it's not even an automatic betrayal emergency.
No, I think that's fair, though, because context should matter.
No,
even though the AI doesn't handle the nuance of context very well.
I'm just saying that kind of the way that this is written by A Clue Without, like, it makes it sound like, backstabbing an ally is going to result in an emergency, and I'm just pointing out that that's not even necessarily the case. If you're, if everyone else has, like, no diplomatic favor, like, at all, because you can see how much diplomatic favor everyone has on the, when you're in the World Congress screen, and also if you have the little info panel thing open in the top right that shows all the leaders' stats, you can see how much diplomatic favor they have. And if you've got 300 diplomatic favor and everyone else has like 10, you can do pretty much whatever you want. You're immune to emergencies targeting you at that point.
Couldn't you just buy the diplomatic favor off the person you're betraying so they can't?
There's that too, although you get to a point in the game where the AI has just become completely unwilling to sell diplomatic favor like at all. So you can only do that in, like, the first half to two-thirds of the game.
And you have to actually care about the emergency in the first place, too, which...
Yeah, that's the other thing, is the other civs have to pose a military threat to you, and if you're out conquering everyone else, then that's unlikely to be the case.
Yeah, you're more likely to have the, aw, how cute, you're going to try and kill me now.
I mean, free money?
It's still good that they have this mechanic that allows the other civs to gang up on a, potentially steamrolling aggressor. Like, so that's definitely good. We want that in the game. It still doesn't quite have the teeth that it maybe, should diplomatically or economically. Maybe we'd be better with some kind of economic sanction option as opposed to, like, declare war against the strongest military in the game and hope that you win. And if that strongest military in the game ends up winning that emergency, they just get more military bonuses. So
you can cancel somebody's trade routes through one of the World Congress options, but there's no option to trigger that at a non-World Congress time, which we kind of need.
And
to be fair, if everybody declares on you, you probably don't have foreign trade routes any longer.
It's true. Although, well, maybe the city-states.
City
states,
yeah.
That's true. But anybody, you already have some equivalent of economic sanctions if everybody's at war with you, because...
Yeah, I mean, that is true.
You're not going to be trading. Your top value trades are probably not available any longer. Not that you probably care by that point, but it is something. I also think there should be, even after an emergency, there should be some similar dogpiling going on if somebody's near victory. That's just me.
And not even near victory, but even earlier in the game, if somebody is steamrolling, like you have those civs like Alexander that will just conquer everyone, around them. And, you're on the other continent and you finally research your caravels, you go over to the other continent and you see that it's just solid gray, all Macedonian cities. because nobody earlier in the game decided, you know, hey, maybe we, you know, should all band together and not let that happen.
The problem, too, though, is that the AI, even when it declares joint wars, like, or whatever, does not actually coordinate its units, so I don't know that it would make much difference right now.
No, and they, might also, and they might also declare joint wars and not even have the units to be able to fight that war. Like, that's something the AI does a lot as well.
Yeah.
You know, they declare that joint war, and then they suicide their two crossbowmen and one swordsman, and, oh, now they just don't have an army.
Or they do like we do with the AI sometimes. You go along with the joint war just for the diplomatic favor towards that AI to you, but you're not really actually going to attack.
Yes, the CK2 method of honoring alliances.
I think that's a paradox in general.
This is something that goes back into a complaint I often make about overstacking defenses in the game. Because when you have somebody who's outnumbered, you have an asymmetric scenario where, like, unit position could really matter if you have to fight two or three nations, and if you don't allocate your resources properly, you just start losing cities because, like, you can't put your army everywhere. But it's just the raw power of cities and walls and encampments stacked together like that instead of six means relatively little units can hold off way more.
Or that, at all.
Or in some cases, yeah, they just cannot break the city.
It is perfectly viable in Civ 6 to have your entire military be in another, you know, nation's borders and still fend off an attack in your homeland.
Yeah, and to me that's somewhat ridiculous, and it really hurts the benefit of some of these coalitions. Because now it's much more difficult for a multi-angle attack or multiple ships fighting you to be a threat.
Especially if they're not coordinating with each other on how to actually go about that, and they're just suiciding their units into your walls.
Yeah.
I mean, I see plenty of situations where, you know, you kill all of an enemy's melee units that are near your cities, and then their ranged and siege units just sit there and don't do anything until you bombard them to death. Like, they don't flee and retreat and regroup and come back. Or take up defensive positions to prevent you from counterattacking. They just sit there until you kill all of their units because they can't take the city.
And I'll compare this to earlier, Sis, where this really was a threat, and it could happen sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't plan well.
Civ 4.
You could get attacked on a flank and lose cities, and that would set you back a lot.
Well, in Civ 4, if you didn't have a unit in the city, like an enemy unit just literally walks in and takes the city, like no resistance at all. And one of the things you had to worry about, particularly in the first half of the game, is barbarians could do that.
Yeah.
If you left your cities undefended, a barbarian camp could just spawn a few tiles from your borders and literally just their axemen or whatever could just walk in, and now the barbarians own half your empire. Because you didn't leave it to
the barbarian events.
Yeah, let's not get into the events. We didn't need events for that, but yeah.
At least you can see that modern is coming.
I like the modern barb design more than I like Civ 4, but I like the fact that Civ 4 forced you to actually invest to defend your cities and position your armies properly. That is something the newer Civs did not get right. And it's still a problem in Civ 6.
Well, at least not
the static defenses have been buffed, which was the wrong direction. Defenses were already overstrong at vanilla release in Civ 6.
Well, the walls are an investment. It's an investment that you make once at the beginning of the game. And in many cases, ancient walls are, like, sufficient to fend off the AI.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if your cities
are close. Yeah, they're more than sufficient in most cases.
Yeah, especially if your cities are close together and you have encampments and, like, your cities are making three bombardments on an enemy unit per turn.
In addition to them shielding multiple ranged units, potentially.
Yeah, but they're definitely...
Yeah, it's,
I would like to see some kind of happy medium between Civ 4, where, you know, your cities are completely undefended, and Civ 6, where your cities defend themselves with no military presence at all.
I guess, because you can't fight back unless you have walls. It's a representation of, like, a standing militia type of a thing, even if it's not a proper military.
Yeah, but isn't that also, like, what a barracks should do? I mean,
know, like maybe you can't, like even if you build the city walls, it gives you the hard defense, but you can't shoot back without a barracks or something.
I mean, I'm thinking of examples like, say, Total
or
War.
Or in the city.
Where, like in the Total War games, like your cities do have a militia retainer, but they're, like, incompetent. I mean, like, they're really weak, they have very low morale, they're easily broken, and they're just not very effective. So if the enemy comes at you with even a remotely sizable force, and you don't have anything other than your city militia to defend that city, like, you're gonna lose the city. They are just gonna completely overwhelm that militia.
That's reasonable, though, and it's also true, like, if they do need at least enough to overcome that militia, so that it's not like they can attack you with basically nothing.
Right, which is
so
why I'm
they need
there
a minimal investment to take the city.
Yeah, there should be a happy medium, like I said. Like, building walls should allow your cities to fend off an invasion for a little while, but they shouldn't allow you to defeat the enemy, you know, invasion army.
Shit, I've literally done that with the city and encampment.
Yeah, I think we all have at some point.
And especially, I mean, like, just camping even just one crossbowman in one of those cities is also just, like, a huge advantage because you can't damage the crossbowman inside.
Yeah,
even if you do have a military force present, even just a tiny one, like, it's just so overwhelmingly strong. But, yeah, we've talked about that many times before, and that's, like, the opposite of the topic of alliances that we were supposed to be talking about.
Next topic.
The one other thing he did want alliances is a mix, that it isn't always strictly gold, strictly science. You know, like, maybe you could have some of both.
How about more of one type of alliance? How about a type of military alliance that doesn't have those bonuses, so you can have a defensive pack with more than one civ?
Yeah, having...
Or just having defensive packs, yeah.
That would work.
That wouldn't be bad.
Being a separate thing, I think would be a nice...
Some sort of taxi system where we could have different... We could have, the multiple of the same type with somebody. Like, no, if you do economics this guy, you're watched out from economics this other guy. Well, why can't I trade with both of them?
And I've said on many occasions that I actually missed the concept of the Pact of Secrecy that was in Vanilla Civ 5. I would like to be able to go to, you know, AIs or other players and, you know, come to an agreement with them that, hey, we are going to be actively working against this third civ, you know, even if we're not going to go to war with them, but, like, we're going to agree to not trade with them and to, you know, do anything we can to oppose them, you know, up to and including potential warfare in the future. But then again, the civs in, or the AIs in Civ 6 in particular are so fickle. They might agree to that one turn, and then next turn, you know, joint war with that civ against you. So,
it's okay. Just hit them for the betrayal emergency. No problem.
So, yes. All right. Well, I guess we're moving on then. So, moving away from alliances. Last time we talked about how incredibly overpowered, possibly Grand Columbia, and their crap ton of military bonuses was. And now we have a topic on Civ Fanatics from Ted Hebert, saying Lahore Nahang is even more OP than Grand Columbia. This person is saying that they still think Grand Columbia is OP, but that the Llanero and Haciendas are less impactful than I expected, which is interesting because I just saw a unique unit tier list from somebody on Twitter. I think it might have been Potato McWhiskey, which put the Llanero in, like, the top tier. So apparently there's some disagreement about whether or not that unit's actually good.
You can make a case just because Grand Columbia tends to have one by the time it's available. That unit's bonuses are incredible, to be fair.
Yeah, like, by itself, the Llanero is, not good. But if there's, like, five of them, then, they're very good.
Yeah, bundle of them with their special grade general, and yes, they're very powerful. But on their own,
not a singular unit, but as a unit on its own, like, if you gave that unit to another civ and had it working with a regular great general, you would still be extremely powerful because of the way it can boost its own strength like that when near others. That's crazy as a bonus. It's very good.
But anyway, this forum topic is about whether the Lahore or Nahang is even more OP than Grand Columbia. And to be honest, I'm actually like struggling to remember what the heck Lahore and Nahang are in this game. Are those unique units?
Well, no, Lahore is a city-state that got added,
yeah.
And Nahang is their special unit. Somebody actually put a picture at one point of a real live version of that guy. Really
I might
cool.
not have actually seen either of those two new city-states in the game yet, which is why I wasn't sure what the heck this was talking about.
It's a city-state unit that you gain, and it's like 200 gold, or 200 faith each time you buy it, and it levels up its strength based on how many encampment buildings you have. So if you have an encampment and a barracks in the classical era, it's as strong as a legionary.
Oh, it's a city-state that actually gives you a unique unit.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have definitely not seen that in the game yet. So I did not know that was there. That's interesting.
He's saying he's got 65 strength for him at turn 170 on standard speed. Is that really out of line with what you could get just building units by then?
Turn 150?
170.
65 strength? I think we're talking probably at least late medieval, early renaissance.
Turn 170 is renaissance, yeah.
Yeah, and so since he's saying their cores, like, to me, this is not too far out of line with just, like, a musket.
Yeah, muskets, like, what is it, like 40, 50, something like that? Attack
it's in the 50s, but a musket core would have more.
Yeah, musket core would probably be at least 60.
Yeah, so, like, that's right in line with this.
Well, the other issue that this user is bringing up is that apparently the cost does not scale up for each one.
No.
I don't think it should, because he's like, you don't get cost scaling up for regular units either. And I don't know that this is out of line, really.
It's not really because, well, at least in my opinion, because not only do you have to have an encampment to get them strong, you also have to have some form of faith income by them and not be using that faith for other things like, you know, monumentality stuff and Jesuit education stuff or even just having a religious base in the first place since religion sucks.
And if you have encampments, you can probably make pretty good units yourself because you're investing into the ability to produce them. Yeah, I don't know. These might be maybe a little bit better / more efficient than muskets, but do they? What's an upgrade path? I haven't used them.
They don't upgrade, but every time you build an encampment building, they increase in strength.
By how much? Like, how many encampments would you need to keep them competitive late game?
No, not number of encampments, number of encampment building type. So
okay. Once
you get to late eras, they don't grow anymore.
And it's the building that you build, it's like the most...
Oh, it's just like a barracks and then an armory and... Okay. So what do you get for each of those from them?
I think it's like 20 strength.
20 strength for encampment building?
No, per 20 strength for the barracks, 20 strength for the armory, and 20 strength for the academy.
If I'm understanding it, it's based on the highest level of encampment building that you've built. So if you have a barracks anywhere in your empire, you get one bonus. If you have an armory anywhere in your empire, you get the next level of bonus, etc. Right?
Yeah, this just looks like it replaces the infantry line for you if you want it to. It's okay.
200 faith does seem pretty cheap, though. I think, because, I mean, you can generate a lot of faith, especially compared to production.
Yeah, but you're getting an infantry unit, right? Like, you still need something else to break cities. and you can only show so many into one spot.
True, but you would spend all your production building ranged and siege units and then spend all your faith on building these, and like the big difference is faith comes from your entire empire, whereas production that's spent towards unit can only be in the one city that's producing the unit. So I can see that potentially being an imbalancing factor where you can just spam so many of these.
Or it would be if you didn't have to invest heavily in producing faith at the expense of being able to produce other things, and on top of that, to hold the city-state loyalty as well. So it's not like you're not paying things to access this unit.
Yeah, to me it sounds like the counter to this is that if you see this city-state and you can't reliably suzerain it, you destroy it. You conquer it.
I wouldn't care. Especially in a single-player game, I would not give a crap if the AI had this.
Yeah, and then possibly even raise the city. Well, the AI, yeah, but like another player is probably going to use it much more effectively.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd care about another player. Let's think about that.
And it looks like a lot of the criticisms in the forums are actually talking about earlier in the game. Like, I see several people comparing them to Roman legions. So, you know, classical medieval units, where apparently this thing is just as strong as a legion, but is, like, considerably cheaper.
But you're still paying 200 faith, even early game, right? And if we're talking, like, classical era, it is much less practical to get a lot of, to many copies of 200 faith. It's not like you're getting 80 faith a turn or something in the first, like, 20 turns.
I don't think when I've concentrated on religion, I don't think I've seen it go above 100 until much later in the game. So this is not like you can buy one every turn or something like that. This is like four or five turns of saving it or longer to buy one, and that's comparable to trying to build more expensive units.
Yeah. I think even on like deity level, if you want to kill an AI, you're probably better served just building an encampment and getting the swords out faster, rather than trying to invest heavily in faith so you can faith buy these units, but then you still need to get a great general, or else these units won't even be significantly better than a sword with a great general.
Yeah, it's hard for me to comment much on this, because I've, like I said, yet to see this city-state in a game, so I have not played with these units or against these units, so I don't know how they pan out in practice.
They were in the game that I played as the Maya. I found them right away. They were pretty average. They didn't really seem to, they didn't stick out to me as particularly good.
But to Maki's point about how much faith you can generate per turn, I mean, I have played some religious games where, you know, by like the medieval era, I'm generating close to or as much as 100 faith per turn. It just really depends on if you get some really good adjacency bonuses for your holy sites. And how hard you push, you know, getting all the buildings and stuff constructed.
Oh, yeah. With some of the stuff right now in Apocalypse mode, I've seen this in different live plays of the game that people are doing ridiculous. What did somebody ask the other day? Like a 10 adjacency place because the volcano had gone off multiple times and is in this spot. And especially if you start triggering off the volcanoes, you know, we've seen that as a sort of a exploit video where you can just make the most ridiculous adjacency cities. I mean,
it was the it was using the Great Bath and then the Soothsayers to just repeatedly trigger flood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you just keep buying. And yeah, in a game like that, oh, these guys are cheap, but most of the time they're not.
Well, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about just a regular game. I've played games where I've gotten probably close to 100 per turn by like the end of the medieval era. I had to conquer, you know, a couple civs that had their own holy sites and, you know, had, like, you know, 10, 15 cities with, you know, multiple holy sites with shrines and temples and the religious building all in them in order to get that much faith. But it's definitely doable. And it's also probably going to depend on, like, game speed and stuff like that. The more time you have to get to, you know, having that many cities and that much infrastructure, the easier it's going to be to reach that threshold. So I do not see, like, being able to build one of these things every, you know, 2 to 4 turns as being super unrealistic. Like, that seems to me like that's probably doable for a civilization that focuses hard on faith. But as Phil keeps pointing out, you also have to focus hard on military because you got to have those encampments. But I guess only one encampment is sufficient because it's not a perk encampment thing. It's just based on the level of buildings that you have.
Well, sure, but if you want if you want good stuff, like you're going to have a good, you would have to get enough to get a great general, and you probably want to be able to build other military unit types as well. So in practice, I'm not sure one encampment cuts it. But maybe it does if you have access to the city. And you're, like, the time I could see this being useful is if you're not, like, going all in on military and you want some extra help from it, right? So now you can use this as a supplement to make a decent military.
Yeah, I mean, I could probably also see this as being something that a religious civ uses, or a religious strategy uses to pivot towards a more militaristic strategy, because now you leverage religious play for the first half of the game, and now suddenly you have access to this, special unit that you buy with faith that's comparable to other, contemporary units. And then you just spam those, and then after that point, once you've got that religious infrastructure built up, then you focus on building military stuff. So I could see this panning out in that way, but I don't necessarily know that that's, like, overpowered, because you can do the same thing with the religious belief that lets you buy units with faith, and buy any unit.
Yeah, and that doesn't scale up in costs. Well, it does with tech, but not with...
I think it goes up each era, but it's not like building the missionaries and apostles, where every time you chase by one, the cost for them all goes up.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not seeing the overpowered. I think it's a reasonable choice in some contexts, but not that much scarier than contemporary units by the time you can get enough faith to get a lot of them.
Faith buying units in general is fun, although it requires you to... Holy sites.
Yeah, I had.
So I guess useful in a apocalypse.
Yeah, I had a Norway game recently where I focused pretty hard on faith early and was faith buying, lots of units in the middle game, and it was a pretty darn good military game.
Theocracy, maybe.
Yep, theocracy.
I see theocracy used against me when some civ shows up at the door with like a zillion units, and I get look at their, oh, they switched to theocracy. Now, you see, I should know by now when I see that to start building units, because that means somebody's about to do an army. I just, at least in the games I've had, it seems to go hand in hand.
Reminds me of a famous old Polycraft quote, or Polycast quote. You see your neighbor, and they change to vassalage, theocracy and police state. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
No, that was even less subtle.
But yeah, even having not played against this unit, I'm still not certain that I would even remotely say it's stronger than just being Grand Columbia, because there's also a lot more counterplay to, getting a special unit from a city-state, because other civs could conquer and raise that city-state, or they send Imani there and, flip its suzerain. So, there's not much counterplay against Grand Columbia's bonuses, like other than just being able to kill them early in the game before they can use them. Whereas this, there's plenty of counterplay.
I'll have to remember Imani in the next, when we have our next show and we talk about that at one of the topics. Because I never use Imani, and it's probably a bad thing.
Imani definitely has...
Yeah, even I use Imani.
Yeah, it's bad, I know.
Yeah, there's almost always like that one city-state that some AI is just really aggressively like charging for, and you just end up having to use her if you want to keep that city state.
I remember the coup chains; those were fun in Civ 5. Why does the Civ why does the city state have like 500 influence with it? Oh, because two civs have been fighting over it for 25 to 30 to 50 turns, and they're just flipping it over and over.
No mine.
That seems like a good time for a spy.
Oh yeah, I've seen plenty of games where there's like one or two city states that have like 15 envoys in them from like a single civ, and then like the next civ has like 14 or 13, and then every other city state in the game has like two envoys total.
Actually, the best practice in that case is probably to conquer the thing.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what it is. If it's a relatively mediocre bonus, just leave it alone and take all the other city-states for yourself.
That's true. Yeah, if there's an AI versus AI slap fight going on over a crap city, then sure, yeah, just ignore it.
Yeah, just let them have
it. And they're dumping, you know, resources into it that they could be spending into other things. So, you know, and they're probably not going to get that much of a bonus if they're constantly fighting over it, because the thing's probably spending half the game not suzerain to anybody, because they have the same number of envoys.
What's the city-state that gives... The city-state that I see it happen to the most is the one that gives, like, 20% production bonus to the city projects. Is that Brussels?
That sounds correct. I think that's Brussels, yeah.
Because Brussels is either that or the Wonders, but whichever one that is, they seem to love that. And they just go over and over and over it, and I'm just like, okay, I'll just sweep up all these others. I'll take Nanmadol, I'll take all the other city-states. I'll take Bratislava. Bratislava still in there?
I think so.
I haven't played a lot of games lately.
It's a cavalry unit, right?
Say what?
It's a boost to cavalry units, right?
I don't know. I haven't played a lot of Civ lately because I've been sick, but I just know that most of the city-states are just kind of ignored by the AIs. And then there's one or two that are just, everybody loves them.
Yep.
So I just pick up all the ones nobody else wants.
It would make sense if it's a Wonder City, though, because the AI is also obsessed with Wonders.
Especially Quan. What's it? Quincy Huang? Is that his name?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if you're pronouncing it correctly, but yeah. But
probably not. Mr. China.
Mr. Ho Ho Ho, leave the Wonders to me.
Mr., I'm going to drink mercury so I live forever and die at age 30.
Yeah, didn't work so well.
Oh, well, we shouldn't make fun of people who lived back then. They didn't know.
Hey, for all he knew, it could have given him superpowers.
Maybe it did.
I mean, that's the origin story for many a superhero.
Drinking mercury?
Well, no, not that specific. But consuming something that, you know, would have actually killed them. I mean, that's like half of Marvel's characters is they got struck by a lethal dose of radiation and now they have superpowers.
Not half of Marvel's characters, but half of their old characters. Because they made a whole lot.
Well, yeah, that's true. Like, every Golden Age Marvel character except for, like, Iron Man was just radioactive.
When the reality should have gotten bitten and died.
Well, it's part of the whole 1950s and 60s thing where radiation was the new hotness.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's like nanotech and genetics.
Yep.
Which are closer to plausibility, although the powers granted to the superheroes still stretches that.
Well, it's superhero comics. They're all weird.
Yeah. But at least we're getting closer to something that would actually let you do abilities beyond normal human capability.
Hey, there's actually, you know, like military exosuits and stuff like that. Those are actually like a thing that exists now and are, I don't know about being used, but at least being, you know, like human and field tested.
I'm relatively certain that they're just in reserve for when they're needed. Sort of like that helicopter that we took out Bin Laden with.
Yeah.
The pilot helicopter, yeah.
Just one for when they're needed. I would imagine that that's going to be relatively long-term tech, because that's not going to be cheap, and it's not like an exosuit is going to hold up to military hardware that well, still.
Well, the way it works with the U.S. DARPA stuff is, basically, if you've started hearing about it in the media, we've had it for 10 to...
Yeah.
They're on to something else now.
And besides, the future of warfare is probably just going to be all autonomous weapons anyway. You know, why get your soldiers killed when you can just, you know, kill the enemy with a drone or a AI-driven tank?
Because they're cheaper.
And the next thing you know, we decide to build one Zilla Henry shape, and the next thing you know, we have Cylons. Oops, Battlestar Galactica.
We do have to be careful about
things.
Once we have general AI, no, we need to be careful before we have general AI.
Yeah, like right now we need to watch how we program these things just in case. You
don't
know.
Yeah, I think there's been several attempts to ban, like, fully autonomous weapons, and so far I think they've all failed. Because of the United States and Russia basically saying, we want to keep researching these things because no one else can build them yet and we're the only ones. So we have a decided tactical advantage.
Interesting that there's very minimal, I mean, you have like drones replacing air balloons and SysX, but there's very minimal future tech stuff that involves automated units or autonomous units.
Maybe the giant death robot. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be piloted in SysX's lore or whatever the heck you want to call it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the source material for that, you would have a human being in it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't SysX. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a Metal Gear, is what it is.
Yeah.
Metal Gear?
Oh, boy.
I don't know if I've seen...
Right, this was a podcast about SysX at some point.
I don't know that I've seen a story with those giant robots where there's not a human piloting them. Maybe. There's got to be one out there somewhere in media.
What is it? Evangelion? I mean, there's the human-piloted ones, but then there's the ones that come from space, which are, I don't even know what the hell that is.
In one of the Gundam series, the Gundam Wing series, part of the storyline revolved around how the villain of the piece was very upset that they were developing non-human-controlled robots because it turned war into a game.
Okay, so it is. It has been done.
And then there was that classic episode of Star Trek where they simulate the entire war in a computer and then they just tell people to step into the disintegration chambers because the computer declared them a casualty.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, couldn't we do this so we don't have to kill people?
Well, the reason they did that was because they didn't want all of their infrastructure being wiped out and they didn't have to rebuild. But they were okay with sending people... They didn't want their entire civilization being bombed back into the Stone Age, but they were okay with just sending, you know, thousands or millions of people into suicide booths in order to, actually make the war, like, have actual consequences.
You'd have to think that the people on the losing side could agree in advance that if they would lose, rather than being disintegrated, that they take concessions to the enemy. But, okay, whatever.
Well, the fear was that if you didn't send your people into the disintegration chambers, then that would cause the other faction to actually start using real weapons and start blowing things up for real. So they didn't want
Can
to...
Can we stop talking about this, please?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. We're a little in the weeds.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Good fuck.
Okay. Well, this is an episode 363 of Polycast. I'm Makalu, and back again, Kenneth Albinus.
Please, no more Star Trek.
Me and team.
Always bringing you the best aspects of sci-fi.
And Mega Bears fan.
Stepping back from the Star Trek weeds.
Well, we're all a bunch of nerds here anyway.
I mean, I write science fiction on my own, but nothing that involves disintegration of people.
Yeah.
Well, there is a war going on, but it's mostly explosions rather than disintegration.
You have a pretty similar end effect if the explosion is powerful enough, I'm just saying.
There was maybe a scene where there was an explosion in the orbit of a planet and an entire battle group got wiped out.
Oh boy, alright, this is
we don't disintegrate people here, we just separate all their atoms.
Just
explode it. We separate their atoms with sheer force. Much more humane.
Copyright. Paul, this, no, but. I haven't done this in a while, can you tell? Copyright for access for Civilization 4, 5, and 6 soundtrack. Copyright the Polycast of Polycast.net.